from runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 170 with guest Dana Epp, recorded Thursday, July 22nd, 2010. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. With me, as always, or at least most of the time, my good friend Greg Hughes.
How you doing?
I'm well, sir. You know, it's summertime. What am I doing? I'm smoking ribs. That's what I do.
Well, good.
It's a party every weekend in the Fancy New backyard. I tore apart one of my water-cooled PCs full of aluminum oxide in the water lines. Not good. Little bits of white debris. So I'm not happy about that. I'm going to have to disassemble the water jackets and clean them all out. It's bad. So, you know.
Very cool. See, my version of playing around with water in the summertime is get out in jet skis or a boat or something and go out and avoid computers like the plague.
Yeah, there you go. It's just a good time to be repairing stuff. I got to get things fixed up. I'm not traveling so much right now, so trying to get gear in good shape. Absolutely. But hey, let's jump on to the guest because I think we have a really cool story today because I've brought back Dana Epp. So Dana, I don't even know if I want to do this whole bio. You're still the CEO of Scorpion Software?
I am.
So you haven't really changed jobs a whole lot. Security seems to be your focus. Got a bunch of cool products out there. Before the show, we were having a little discussion about the challenges of development environments. But we had a conversation, you and I, a week ago or so. You were in the middle of a big security panic that I thought would make a very interesting conversation. So why don't we go all the way back to the beginning of that? And tell me what you found.
So, interestingly enough, we actually had a vulnerability in one of our products. And, you know, part of our product set includes some authentication mechanisms that provide two-factor authentication when logging on to Windows server and workstations. And it ends up that we actually had a customer report to us a problem that they were having, which was more indicative of a bigger problem. And it ended up being a vulnerability that would allow in certain situations when using the Windows Credential Manager to save creds to bypass the entire plumbing of the API Microsoft makes available for this stuff that we were using. And that became a panic for us because obviously, you know, our agents are running on thousands upon thousands of servers. And in this particular case, it's a very isolated. It's all for administrator accounts on Windows Server 2003 only, and only when certain policies are applied. But it still was a critical vulnerability because used in an inappropriate way would give you a way to bypass the system, which would not be good.
So this started out with a customer finding what he thought was a bug in your product.
Yeah, and you know, ultimately it is a bug in our product. Right. It was a vulnerability that exists because we were exasperating it because of the way we were doing something. But what's interesting is they didn't see it that way. They just thought it was, if this isn't working, can you please tell us what's going on?
Right.
So we leverage Hyper-V very heavily here for everything we do. And so when a case like that comes in to customer service, they open up basically a technical research case, which then what they do is try to repro that. And if they can repro that, they record that repro in a way so that the developers can see it, and then they attach it to an actual developer case in the defect tracking system. And at that point, we can then replay that at any time because they can share the VHDs and the developers can see what the root cause is and then, you know, look at what we need to do to fix it.
Right.
And in this scenario, they are looking to just do this underlying problem, and they're like, you know what? This actually is a bigger problem than the customer realizes. And that was when I got involved because at this point it was a security issue and we had to go back to day one and take a look at the threat model and take a look at the entire attack plan of what the issue was. And we were able to find it was indicative of a much bigger problem, which we had to actually get Microsoft involved in because it didn't just affect us. It actually affected many of our competitors. So interestingly enough, we know two of our competitors that had the same problem. So We've released our fix already, and they're going to be releasing theirs pretty quick, I'm told.
So who do you phone at Microsoft when you think there's a security vulnerability in one of their APIs?
So here's what's really interesting in that scenario is that Microsoft has a triage team for security stuff, but it's for effectiveness of security stuff of their stuff. So if it is a bug in Office or in Windows itself, you can call them up and they have an incident triage team that takes care of all that kind of stuff. But this is different because this is a third-party audit that is part that belongs to us, and we had to go through the traditional developer support channels, which actually was quite frustrating for me because being a Microsoft security MVP, I have some internal access to some people, which allows me to kind of sidestep the standard help cases.
Right.
And I tried actually using some of that, but because of the complexity of what was trying to be accomplished, that didn't go so far. So I went so far as to reach out to my developer evangelist. I reached out to some of the guys down at Redmond, and it came to the point there's only two people currently in Microsoft that are dealing with support of this particular issue because it's Windows Server 2003 legacy stuff.
Right.
And so we had to actually open up a proper support case, have it go through the standard, you know, tier one triage. The good thing was, though, is I had full documentation of exactly what was going on, and I actually said, here is the escalation engineer we need to get to. And the nice thing was is within 24 hours after that, it was to that person, and I had already sent him an email in advance saying, this is coming to you. As soon as you get this case number, please pick it up. And he did, and then we were able to get right down and dirty, and he was able to look at the code, and that was what was the critical component, because we knew that what we had found was against what the public documentation was on MSDN for it.
The documentation says it's supposed to work this way, and it's actually working this way.
Right, and what ends up happening is it wasn't a failure in the documentation, it was a lack of documentation, because it also comes down to this one thing. You can set up policy in Active Directory that says it always prompt for password.
Right.
Well, the theory is that it states there that will take care of any remote connections. Well, that's not entirely true. What it is that it takes all for standard terminal services RDP connections, not console-based remote sessions. And that's actually a separate policy setting, which is an entirely different area in Windows. And so we didn't know what we didn't know. And so ultimately what ended up happening was this was an attack vector that we just simply did not have in our threat model. And what's funny is in our original threat model, we had explored what would happen in this scenario. And what we ended up doing was contacting Microsoft and asking, okay, how do we deal with this? And they said, well, you just adjust this policy and this policy will take care of it. And we're like, oh, perfect. Okay, we'll just do that as part of our install and our maintenance and that will take care of it. Well, not quite. We didn't ask the question large enough. We should have asked, and where else could that policy be applied?
Right.
And that was what we missed. And the fix is actually really even more interesting.
Now, I noticed that one thing that, you actually have a threat model, which, I mean, if you're doing, authentication and security type software, then one would certainly hope that you would, but it's amazing, even in with new software being developed today out there across the industry, how few organizations are doing threat modeling.
Yeah, I get the luxury of obviously working a lot with and learning a lot from Microsoft Teams. And over the last, I'd say almost 8-9 years now, they've really matured in their own development philosophy. And things like the SDL
right.
process, the security development lifecycle that Microsoft uses in its own products, have been indicative of I'm going to say they've been incubating lots of other new technologies. So I've had the luxury of being an early adopter of their threat modeling tool set. They actually have a tool set that makes this extremely easy. You basically
right.
build data flow diagrams in what seems like a Visio-based tool set, and then it will help you to generate a list of threats based off of how the data flows in that system. And that helps us to explore before we write a single line of code what kind of risks are going to exist there, and more importantly, what can we do to mitigate them? And that's important. It's not just security software that should do this. All software should be doing this. But in our case, and as we've seen, threat modeling is not a panacea. It will not solve everything. It will only solve and point out the things that you are very clear about understanding. And it's what you don't know that always bites you, which is what got us on this vulnerability.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, could you have tested for this? Like, it's one of those things where you're trying to find all the particular combinations. This version
of
the OS.
Well, hindsight's 2020.
Absolutely.
Now we know we could have tested for it,
right,
because
right.
now we know what to look for. But at the time, we didn't, and that was the thing. And that was interesting about the fix, was because when I got involved in the fix side of it, I actually went deeper than most people would have to make sure that the class of vulnerability that this was gets eliminated. So we actually did API function pointer manipulation in the system. So we know what causes the review of Microsoft's Gina components to look for these policy decisions. And what we did was we basically created a proxy or a hijack where we take the function pointer which Microsoft's code is calling into, and they think they're calling into the underlying API, but they're actually calling into our code. And then we call into the code underneath the hood to get the policy decisions, and then we manually adjust it where we have to have it to maintain a secure state. And then we pass that down to them. They see no difference. It completely functions properly, and all we've done is we've manipulated the function pointers and memories in a way that is stable and reproducible, and in a way that we can guarantee that we can manipulate the credential struct the way we need to provide a safe set of policy decisions.
And it gets back to also protecting the customer from themselves, because they could set up a set of policies there that would undermine your product entirely.
That's right. And it might even be indirectly. You know, RSOP has it where a policy decision in one place may affect policy elsewhere. Or worse yet, and the attack vector that we were looking at, because as soon as we find something like this, this is where I actually enjoy getting involved in this kind of stuff, because we start looking as the attacker. Okay, so here's what we know. Ultimately, policy decisions in Active Directory will boil down to this registry setting. If I have an ability to mount that registry setting remotely, I can change that to this, and then what happens? Oh, I can bypass the system. I can bypass any Gina-based system doing that. Okay, so that's bad. Okay, what can we do to deal with that? Simply changing policy wasn't enough, because it was actually possible for a rogue agent to be able to manipulate that remotely and then get in and bypass it. Now, granted, they still have to have administrative credentials, but we're talking about an administrator access point here where we're trying to restrict it. You can't stop it. Administrators can uninstall the products for at the end of the day. But we wanted to make sure that it was auditable, so we know when they do those type of events. And so by manipulating it the way we did, even if they change the policy settings, it doesn't matter, because we will dynamically, as the policy decision is being made inside the WinLogon process, we actually are manipulating it to what we want it to be. And so it doesn't matter what it's actually set to. We will always force it to prompt for password. Now, there's a downside to that, obviously. If any of our customers is looking to use our product in an environment with auto-logon, it will not work. And that's okay. We've documented. If you're using our product, this functionality will not work, and that is a security decision, and we're not going to relinquish that decision.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of functionality that Microsoft has like that too. Or if you have any of this turned on, auto login doesn't work. That's not that unusual.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's a balancing act, right? Security is not an absolute. It's about reducing risk to an acceptable position. And at the end of the day, for what we're doing, and in this case here, it is to provide identity assurance when remotely logging into critical servers. It makes sense. You don't want to have auto-logging capabilities.
Yeah.
You don't want people to manipulate policy in a way to bypass that. And even if someone did, you want to know it. So in our case, if that policy actually gets changed, that gets alerted and bubbled up into the security log, and then we have some management packs for a lot of our IT automation systems like System Center and Kaseya and LabTech and, you know, all these different IT automation systems, so that it can automatically alert, so that the administrators can know instantly when someone's trying to manipulate policy to try to get around it.
I'm loving the idea of you had to go through tier one tech support, because all of us, all three of us, have all been tortured by this.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That whole, thank you for calling, insert name here. You know, that, yep. You guys, it's like, dude, you really have to get off the script. I wouldn't have phoned you if I didn't need tier two. I can do tier one myself.
Yeah, exactly. But they don't know that, right? When they call in, it's one of those things that they just, hey, what's your name? Okay, let me bring you up. Oh, your gold partner. Okay, yeah. And then it's like, well, you know what? Just give me a break. But what's interesting is I'm seeing that Microsoft's seeing that. I don't know if you saw that recent survey that they were asking around, but they're taking a look at the whole concept of being able to map your expertise and knowledge base against where. So you're not wasting time in tier one, and it might get you directly to a tier two scenario. And that could be useful. In my case, it gets worse because Microsoft has process they have in place. I actually knew who I had to get to but I wasn't allowed to talk to him, you know, right. directly. He couldn't solve right. He wouldn't be allowed to take on the case. And I understand why, because, you know, at the end of the day, Microsoft is a business, and they have yeah. to look at this stuff. But I didn't care at that point. I had a security vulnerability I needed to address, and I wanted to fix it as quickly as possible. And it took from point of report of the bug to the point that we released a fix was 1 week. And we spent 3 of those days just going through the Microsoft maze of getting to the right person. So, you know, let me rephrase that. We were looking for indications from them. So during that 3 days, the QA team was testing every other scenario and finding what else they could do. So we weren't stopped. We still could keep working. But I couldn't release a fix until I knew we had indicative to what was the underlying problem going on here. And we can't look at Microsoft's code, but they can. So they can say, oh, yeah, okay, well, here's what it's doing.
Right.
Okay, so then we need to find a better way of fixing it. And I'm quite happy with our fix because it removes an entire class of vulnerability here. I don't have to worry about adjusted policy decisions affecting how our stuff works because we will right. force it to a certain way. And the only risk we can see to this is if that another agent similar to ours is in there and they try to map the function table differently. But, you know, luckily enough, Windows Server 2003 has a very static address set for a lot of their addressing. So we already checked for that a little bit. So
you haven't actually gotten Microsoft to change any code at this point? You just coded around the problem?
They did not. Actually, what's funny is we've done it in a way so we affect Microsoft's code without them changing a single thing. Because originally it was going to be, well, are we going to need to issue a hot fix to this? How are we going to accomplish this? But this wasn't Microsoft's problem.
Right.
It was how we were using the system, and we didn't know about these policy decisions. And in our case, what we do is we do our manipulation, and we pass it back to Microsoft's Gina, which is their components for WinLogon. So what we didn't knew was, okay, well, we have an opportunity before the WinLogon process deals with things to do something. So in our case, what we do is that do something is to remap the function pointers so that when their code goes to call this particular function, our code gets called. And then what we do is we do our map. Now, what's funny is that we couldn't do this in Windows Server 2008. It
really?
Wouldn't be possible because they have defenses to prevent your ability of remapping API calls.
Interesting.
So, but this particular vulnerability is only on Windows Server 2003, so we're actually using what they're protecting against, because rogue elements, imagine, if you will, that a rogue element remaps API calls to do, you know, bad things or keystroke logging or what could be anything. That would be a risk. And so what we did is we used, this is just, you know, standard, you know, computer software engineering is, while pointers are pointers, if you point them to a different location, it will do different things. And that's what we did.
Yeah.
As you've been describing the fix that you did, the one question that's gone through my mind has been, you know, is this a Microsoft-supported methodology for doing it? But
yes, it is. We actually, one of the things is when we did this, we made a very, actually, first off, the type of API calls we use to do this is a fully supported API set from Microsoft. So this isn't one of those hack it behind the scenes kind of thing. We actually use Microsoft API to do this. It's a documented way of giving you a hook into these particular API calls. So that is completely allowed. And more importantly, was we got approval from the support escalation engineer that this is an accepted supported scenario. And so they just obviously document it for their team that we're doing that. And then if there was theoretically someone calling up with a problem in Windows Server 2003 and our agent's there, their team knows what's going on. And that's okay. Because there's actually, it's funny, is for the kind of work we're doing, there are very few companies in the world actually doing this kind of stuff this deep. And
right.
so they know who all the players are. It's
right.
just like in the AV world, they know who all the AV players are. So, you know, there's really only about 35 companies worldwide that are doing this specific type of thing. There's hundreds of guys that are trying to build these type of things, but companies doing supported scenarios across thousands upon thousands of servers, there aren't that many. So they know, and they've seen this. And that was actually, when we found this, we actually, in our lab, we have a lot of our competing products in there that we do for, you know, testing, especially for things like migrations and stuff like that. And one of the things I did is I took a look at two of our competitors and found that they had this bug still. And so we obviously contacted them, and we've provided them with the workaround because it's in the interest of our space to make sure that everyone's
sure.
protected. And they're working on fixes now, which is why I can't go into too much deep details about what's going on, because although our clients are protected, they still, I don't know where they're at with their stuff. They're probably a couple weeks away. So,
but this does sound like it ultimately could end up as a knowledge base article inside of Microsoft. You know,
it might be. I know that they're updating the docs to reflect the difference, but
right.
I don't know if this will become a KB or not. I think that the interesting thing is this is such a legacy problem, and they're trying so hard to get people off of Windows Server 2003 in that scenario. Last thing they want to do is spend a lot of time trying to get that out there. And
right.
KB would make some sense on there, but again, this is a third-party problem. It's not there. It's not like they've engineered anything wrong. It's how we manipulated and used their API, and we had a vulnerability. We had a bug. It was our problem. But what's interesting is we're not the only one. It was an understanding problem in how it works.
But it does indicate a potential vulnerability in a Microsoft API.
Correct. A vulnerable use of the API.
Right.
You know, the reality is, and the thing is, some of our competitors didn't have this problem, which means that they've already came across it or they've known. And so that's one of those scenarios where, you know, we made a mistake ultimately because we didn't know. And that's what, for me, that was bothersome because we spent a lot of time architecting and engineering this to make sure it was right.
Yeah.
And what was interesting was it was right in what we had information to. And then as soon as they made it clear, here's what it's doing, and we're like, okay, well, where the hell is that documented? Oh,
right.
Okay, all right, so now that's the issue. Okay, fine, we'll deal with that, and we'll go forward.
Yeah, how were you supposed to know that you didn't document it?
And that's common. There are tons of Microsoft APIs and policies that aren't rather well documented, and if you know, you know, and if you don't, you don't. And the thing is that what's interesting is I will bet that we would have never had a real risk to a lot of our clients because this is such a convoluted method of doing things that
right.
it may not have been a problem, but that doesn't make it right because it only takes one person to take advantage of that vulnerability to exploit it.
Well,
so,
and that's what happened, right? One customer came along and used this convoluted scenario and surfaced the problem.
Yeah, and so that's the scenario. And so at the end of the day, we take all vulnerabilities very very seriously. And we have a policy that really makes it clear that if someone finds a problem, we'll fix it. You know, we just need a chance to do it before you let the world know.
Right.
And in this case, the customer didn't even realize. And when I reached out to them to explain, hey, I appreciate what you've done. He's like, I didn't realize what I did. And it's like, yeah, okay, well, but thank you anyways. You know, and that's the thing. And so it safeguards everybody, and that's a good thing.
Well, I gotta applaud you for notifying your competition of the issue as well, so they can put the fix and advance the state of the art in their product, because that's not something obviously that you have to do. But what a great
decision thank you for that. You know, not a lot of people will know, and you know, other than the listeners here now will know. That's not something we go out and chant and say, "Woohoo, we found something," and we went and told our competitors.
Sure.
And this is a belief I have, and it's a belief that my team has because I have driven that in our culture is that we will put the protection and security of our clients before the protection of our profits, but still be responsible to our stakeholders. And what that means ultimately is that if we can't solve a problem for a potential customer, or we find that we're not able to service their needs, we will walk them to our competitors. And the reason for that is that we would rather see them obviously get protected because, you know, password security is a very weak form of authentication to start with, and we really like to see people using what they feel is the right solution. And secondly, and this is more important to everything, is that we have, and it's, you know, from a business point of view, we want to see the industry to properly be safeguarded, and the last thing we want to see is vulnerabilities in the type of systems that are being recommended to secure that very infrastructure. So it's in our interest to make sure that their stuff's working. We're confident we stand on our own. In the place that we're focusing on, we do extremely well. We differentiate ourselves in a way that we win a business because we're good at what we do. But there will be times that people will want to go elsewhere, and those might be our very customers, and we want to make sure they're protected. So I don't mind letting our competitors know. And it actually works both ways. We've had competitors bring business to us many times because they don't, you know, they deal with enterprises. They don't focus on the SMB space a lot, and they don't have support for, you know, small business server or essential business server, or they don't have the ways to tie it into direct access the same way we do. And that's great, and I think that we're lucky to be in an industry like that. And ultimately, I think as a security MVP, I also have a higher calling, and that is to make sure that we secure the world. It's not just about securing our profits. We still make money. We'll still do well. We don't need to hide it or flaunt it or cause any other kind of problems for our competitors.
Well, and this is a karma thing too, you know. One of these days, they are going to find a weakness like that, and you'd like that phone call too.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, I do think that the security pros are grossly outnumbered, and you know, you got to band together.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem. From a development perspective, and maybe we're changing gears a little bit here around this. So now, how many seats did you have out there? Is this something you've got to push out to everybody?
Yeah, so we have... So our methodology works that we take advantage of IT automation systems like Active Directory Software Distribution Policy, System Center software packages. We take advantage of Kaseya deployment agents. And so when they get these, so as well as the standalone EXE, we include a MSI and a special MSI builder that will create basically an update pack, and they can just drop it in Active Directory, and it'll automatically push out to everybody and update it in real time. The only issue is Windows Server 2003, unlike our credential providers on Windows Server 2008 and Windows 7 and things like that, Windows Server 2003 requires a reboot because the WinLogon process only loads the code during boot.
Ugh.
So that means that everyone's got to schedule this on a way so that when it's in, you know, non-business time. And the good thing is systems sure. like System Center can look for that. They can tell when there's an idle time when no one's on the system, and they can push it out at that point and force it. And they can even set up aging timeouts, right? So it could say, I need this to be pushed out within the next 48 hours. And they'll, if it can't, it'll alert you to manually go and beat the guy and say, look, it's telling you to reboot. Will you reboot, please?
Right.
So that works out really well. And with a lot of it, we work a lot with managed service providers. And a lot of them actually, these are guys that manage 500 small businesses, and they're managing 17,000 endpoints. And so they can't use things like System Center because those weren't designed for 500 separate domains.
Right.
And that's where companies like Kaseya have these tools that you basically provide a script that can do that. And so when we deployed out the fix, we included prescriptive guidance on how to use these tools to do that. So we included a WMI script that can force a call to get it down. We have a script that will actually dump the MSI to the endpoint and run it so that whatever the environment may be, if it's Enable or if it's, you know, if it's LabTech or all these other vendors, they can all take advantage of using that same script set and push it out. And in many cases, a lot of these guys, you know, they only have, you know, a couple hundred machines that this might affect. But the nice thing is it'll only take them 15, 20 minutes to schedule it and get it updated.
This still gets back to the question of, I mean, this was not an exploit. You know, had not been found in the wild. Was it really worth pushing a hot fix that fast? Shouldn't you just put it into a point rev?
The criticality of the potential. So here's the way that we measure risk ultimately for our code is it's going to be the potentiality, what is the chance that can happen versus the criticality or the damage potential that will ultimately occur if something goes on here.
Right.
At the end of the day, under those particular conditions, if you use the Windows Credential Manager, you use a console remote logon as an administrator, you will bypass two-factor authentication. You still need to know the administrative credentials, so it's not like someone could remotely can just get into the system. But the problem is that you are bypassing the auditability components of being able to say you are actually the valid person authorized to log in here. That, to us, is the highest risk you could possibly have. You have a potential to get onto a system without auditability controls. So for some of our clients that have to meet compliance objectives, they cannot have a scenario like that. So we have to provide a way to fix that. Alternately to that, though, is we knew that there was a problem that was here. Why would we want to hold off and fix it? You know, we use so much test automation here that it doesn't take us a lot of time to validate a fix. And because we use agile coding development here at all times, we're always in a shippable state. So at the end of the day, once we go, we made a shift here. We obviously moved our current sprint around and said, look, guys, we're stopping everything. Let's review this right here. Let's take a look at the threat model. Let's take a look at the test plan of what we have to validate. Okay, can we build an automation test for that? Yes, great. You guys build that. Let's go make this fix. Once the fix is available, run it against those set of tests. And at that point, we have the confidence that it's good. Why would we wait for a point release? There's no reason to. We're just putting businesses at potential risk. And just because we don't know that no one knows about it doesn't mean that it isn't a real exploitable vulnerability that somebody else may or may not know about. You know, the good hackers won't tell you that they have found a vulnerability in your system because they want to use it to their advantage.
Of course, yeah, right. But at the same, so you're saying you abandoned a sprint that was currently underway?
We didn't abandon it, we just paused it. So we do 30-day sprints, and in the process that we normally do that, we know exactly where everything's scheduled, and all we simply did was we, for that 1 week, we just basically adjusted the entire sprint that the sprint stops. We work on this particular thing, and then we got back into the sprint and let it go. And it's actually kind of funny because a couple of guys, they weren't needed. Once I got involved, there wasn't really a lot that the developers could do on that because there would just be conflicting development. So what ended up happening in that scenario is they went back into their sprint to do their bits. There's no reason for them to wait until they were needed. And then what ended up happening in that scenario was it allowed everyone just to keep working. And what's actually kind of funny is we actually were ahead in our sprint anyways. So it looks like, because we're coming near, you know, we're about a week away, the development sprint is done. The testing sprint is in place right now. The way we do our development, we do 2 weeks of dev, we do a week of test and automation to that, and then a review before it gets out there. So what ends up happening at the end of that is we are still on target for all of our sprint items. So we should be okay.
But you've already shipped this fix now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it went out on Monday, or no, last Thursday, actually. So
you sort of did a mini 1 week sprint and shipped a release, and now did you go back to before the sprint in terms of the source you were working with?
So in the scenario, this one, this particular code segment was not in this sprint. So
okay.
What was nice is that we were at a stable code. I think the last bit of that this code was worked on was several cycles ago. So it wasn't a big issue to bring that in. I will tell you that we basically abandoned our standard development methodology for doing a full sprint and review. Because normally what we do is in day one, we're obviously looking through the we're looking at the backlog items. We're taking an idea of what needs to be done. We'll assign that in there. Then we spend half a day updating the threat model to whatever it is there, and updating any other documentation that would be a reflective of what's about to happen. And then they go and do 2 weeks of your dev sprint, and then 1 week of your test sprint, and then you got 1 week of your review and fix sprint. And then in the last day, we do our sprint review, and then from there we then cycle it over, and we spend half a day looking, say, what did we screw up? What did we do really well? What can we do differently? And then we're back into the next month. What happened in this scenario is as soon as this occurred, we couldn't do our standard sprint in a 1 week period, and we didn't know how long it would take us to fix this because we had to really get an understanding of what was going on. Well, a lot of that was first 3 days was hurry up and wait. We were trying to go through Microsoft support channels to get where we needed to. So in that period of time, people could still work on what they needed to get done. And it was, there was only like a 2 days of, you know, everyone was working the full days to code it, because we actually coded three different possible fixes, because we did two based off of our own knowledge of what we could do, because we found a way to bypass, once we found what was the root cause for the policy changes, we found a way to change the policy. But in testing of that, we had found, well, you could bypass the policy by remotely changing the setting. Oh, okay, well, that's not a good thing. We've got to look deeper. And that was at the point when they brought me in and said, okay, well, Dana, you know, what do we do here? And I was like, okay, well, ultimately, what's the call? So we just basically used IDA Pro. We took a look to find out what were the API calls being used. We found the specific call Microsoft's code was calling. We found a way to map it, and we did. And then, this little ingenious C programming with some pointer manipulation, and the rest is history.
It does feel like you were worried about how long it was going to take to Microsoft to respond to you, and we're finding workarounds.
I didn't know how big of a problem this was. How deep was the rabbit hole?
Yeah, what have I stepped in?
It's like, okay, so if there's what other policy decisions are out there? What other things could affect this? What don't we know? And that, for me, you know, I almost take these things personally. And it's not that I should, because it's not like this is my problem, right? This is ultimately a company problem. It's my client's problem. And so it's important that we get it right. And so I know I could go pick up the phone and call some of the guys in the security team and get some deeper knowledge and that stuff. But the problem with that scenario, first off, you burn bridges with friends, and you don't need to do that.
Yeah.
But the second thing was that ultimately, at the end of the day, we needed to have a supportable mechanism on what we're going to do, and that means we had to go through the proper support channels. And what I was worried about, and it actually started going that way when I was just happy that the right guys at Microsoft picked it up, was when you get to Tier 1, they have no clue. This is so deep beyond. They don't even know the API calls. They couldn't even type it out when they're writing it down, and you're like trying to spell it out to them. And you're realizing this is not a very good use of my time, but it's something I have to do. I have to go through this pain to then get to the next level. The problem there is I didn't know how long it would take us to get there. And, you know, we're all on our we're just thinking, going, if someone finds us out, what if this customer goes and tells someone else and they go look deeper? You know, what could this do?
Right.
And at the end of the day, we just wanted to make sure it was done right. And I think we did a good job. I'm very proud of my team. They had the luxury of having all the automation to make their life easier. So when I'm screaming at them to repro this situation, repro this condition, it's a matter of reverting the snapshot, rerunning it against that scenario, reporting that back to me, and then we can make a proper informed decision on what the heck's actually going on.
Well, Dana, a very cool story. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
No problem. It's kind of funny. It's now that everything's calmed down and everything's out, it's nice to look back and just say, what did we just do? and from triage to fix to release, it's these kind of things they consume a lot of time. But when done right, everyone wins, and that's a good thing.
Well, and my contact with this whole thing was you and I were talking about doing another show, and in the middle of planning that, you said, sorry, I have to put everything on hold. We're dealing with a security crisis. And
yep.
And then a few days go by and you're like, okay, it's over. We've got it handled. We should just talk about that. And let's talk about that. And here we are.
There we go.
Dana, thanks so much for coming on the show.
No problem. Thanks for inviting me.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.